a joy to be able to be with you in this regard. I hope that you'll bear with me this weekend because for a while there, I got to where I would use weekend retreats as a time to sort of see how certain things that we've been sort of churning over crystallize together, which is another way to say that I use you as guinea pigs. But there's been some stuff that's been working on me and in a couple of my contexts, especially in dealing with ministry to men in the last 3 years after leaving RUF, that I want to work through with you and see what happens. And it started, to give credit where credit is due, with a talk that I heard a very good friend of mine by the name of Jeremy Jones give about 3 years ago, who is one of the associate pastors at Independent Presbyterian Church in Memphis. And I've not been able to get it out of my mind because of what it suggested about the way in which men process the world around them and process what it means to be a man at this. And I think we're at a crisis point when it comes to us thinking about masculinity in general. I know that theologically there's some interesting things happening and stuff that I'll try to get into as we move along on the weekend as we dive into it. But I want to start where Jeremy started by bringing attention to what is agreed by many people to be one of the most successful ad campaigns of the 20th century. And it was the Dos Equis, the most interesting man in the world commercials. Just to date you and feel how old we all are, those ad campaigns started in 2006, okay? And you remember the whole premise of the most interesting man in the world? It would start out with this guy, and the voiceover was the guy who did all the frontline documentaries, right? And you'd see this guy doing various things as a young man, as a middle-aged man, as an old man, and the voiceover would come and say things like this, would say, when he drives a car off the lot, the car increases in value. Or the one where he says, once a rattlesnake bit him, but after 5 days of excruciating pain, the snake finally died. Or my personal favorite was, he would be in touch with his feminine side if he had one. What you may not know, though, about those commercials is from the time between 2006 and 2010, Dos Equis beer, which was an import, of course, rose 22%, which in itself would not be that interesting except for the fact that every single other import, the nearest closest import, had a net loss of minus 4% during the same period of time. It was unbelievably successful as an ad campaign. And so the article that I was reading about it had interviewed the man who was the actor who played the most interesting man in the world, a man by the name of Jonathan Goldsmith. And the reporter asked this individual exactly who it was or why he thought that the ad campaign was as successful as it was, to which he said this. He said, I think the campaign is so successful because every man, including me, would like to be like him. So where Jeremy was going with this was, is he said that there's more and more evidence that shows that the way in which men in particular do what we would call formation as men comes through models, not fashion models. This is the universal symbol for models. But through looking at someone that I find to be admirable in some way, and I begin to imitate and fashion my life around my understanding of that particular model in life. And that this formative occupation of men in particular, according to some research, women have it in a very different way, that as human beings, we go throughout our lives as model seekers by nature. And model followers by trade, so that what you refer to as you is a very complex amalgam of the people you have either imaginary or real looked at as being desirable. And I patterned myself after them. In other words, when you were a child, there was a specific image of greatness or coolness or goodness or even badness. So some people actually find the bad person to be their model that became for you the formative aspect of your life, the form of became what you wanted to be. And I said to myself, that's who I want to be, that particular person. And there's more and more people that are starting to write about this. There's a guy who used to work for LaBrie Fellowship by the name of Dick Kies, who wrote a book called True Heroism, where he says this. He says, we are not motivated only by abstract principles or rules of right and wrong, or even by rational incentives. Let's stop there for a second. What he's saying is you and I tend to think that the reason why I am the way that I am is because I embraced a set of abstract ideas and principles. There were rules that I said that I was going to follow and live my life by, that I determined myself to be who I was, I committed myself to them, and became who I am. Kais actually says that that's not anywhere near the full story. Look what he says next. He says, rather, we are motivated by stories, images, and accounts of flesh and blood people, even fictional characters who have lived lives in ways that we find exciting, challenging, or admirable. In other words, what happens to us as human beings, especially male human beings, is something or someone or the image of that person captures our imagination. And there's a whole lot of work to be done on exactly what our imagination is, but that's another series for another time. But what happens is we aspire to be like them. We get a mental image of ourselves as them and begin to map our lives around being that. Now look, there's a theological reason why we do that, and that's because God made us that way. Human beings in general are what we would call worshiping creatures. I think of the quote, I'm going to mess this up, so help me, people who know it better, by Jamie Smith, who says, we referred to mankind early on as Homo sapiens, thinking man. But what Smith says is, we actually are more Homo liturgicus. We are worshiping man. By definition, you and I are created to search out things that become power centers, that become wonder centers, that become joy centers. They become rebellion centers for us, and we map our lives after those people. So what we mean then is we start to say, my life, whether it has a trajectory of success or of disaster, is going to be mapped by these images. And I found it to be a very profound, far more interesting self-evaluation exercise to start asking who my models are. Literally, writing them down. Sometimes they can be inanimate, sometimes they can be TV characters. Sometimes they can be people as close as parents, big brothers, friends at school. But once you start to map that out and begin to question those, something very profound happens about your own self-understanding. But when all of a sudden we bring that exercise in with the Bible, we find that something gets very complicated. Because on the one hand, you'll have regular places in the Bible where characters within the Bible are commended to us as genuine models, people for whom we might model our lives. But then on the other hand, you find for those very self-same people, they never come away without dirt being spilt on them. They are always maligned in some way, with very few exceptions, throughout the scripture. And so what I want to wrestle with this weekend is what do we do with the models that come to us in the Bible as men in our search for heroes to model our lives after, to be like? How does the Bible present its own models? How does the Bible present heroes to us? And I think what you're going to find, and what I hope to commend to you, is that when it really comes down to it, there really is only one hero in the Bible. There's only one. The text itself will not allow you to rest on one person as being the be-all, end-all. And what I want to do is I'm going to look at three characters. Tonight I want to look at the life of Moses. And tomorrow morning I'm going to look at the life of David and Peter in two things. Three huge characters in the Bible, all of which at various times I'm sure you were encouraged to emulate in some particular way. But you're going to find in each one of their lives is a fatal flaw. So if you brought a Bible or you have an electronic device, turn with me to Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy 34. I want to read verses 1 through 8. This is the very end of Moses' life. And the writer says this: Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negev and the plain, that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. And the Lord said to him, This is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there. So Moses, servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. And the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab for 30 days. We love to say in our church that grass withers and flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to unpack it, but I do think that we find ourselves in a unique moment in time where Christians are being exposed as being power mongers. Is that fair to say? For quite some time, we have lived in a posture, both politically and socially in America, when Christianity had some kind of social upper hand. We were able basically to exact our wills. We were able to influence politics, at least we thought that we did. And suddenly, when that was threatened by forces outside of ourselves, it was exposed that our longing and our desire for power even would allow us to compromise ourselves in the people that we pledged our allegiance to, dare I say. Hence the apologies for people saying, well, I held my nose when I voted for Donald Trump. Okay, fine. I got no problem with that. But what began to be exposed in Christians was this underlying idea that the real purpose of what we are to do is to go out there and take the world for Christ, to go out there and to sort of protect us from the evil, liberal horde who's moving in on Christian circles. Again, my point here this evening is not to critique that necessarily of itself. But I do think that oftentimes if that mentality of spiritual victory, of believing enough so that you can somehow, you know, enter into the victorious Christian life, is very challenged by stories that we just read. Because Moses, I would argue tonight, and what I want to pitch to you in these last little 15 minutes here, Moses would represent to anyone else who was looking into his life as a failed life. Moses dies on Mount Nebo as a professional failure, by anyone's estimation. Why? Well, let's do a very quick, brief look at Moses' life and see how this all happened to him. First of all, Moses was raised in royalty. We know this. He was adopted out of a racial background that was actually subjugated. He struggled very much, even though he had royal privileges, he struggled with his family of origin, leading him to be a hothead. He had anger issues, Moses. And those anger issues caused him to murder a fellow Egyptian when he saw one of his own countrymen being harmed. And so he hides the body. When all of this is discovered and come to light, he races out into the wilderness to live. You remember all this? But while he's there, God calls him, as the way he is wont to do in wildernesses, to this incredible task. He's going to be a leader. He is going to escort God's people out of slavery and to their true home. Now look, I don't know how you unpack inspirational life missions, right? You may look at your job as the most mundane thing in the world, but if somebody came to you and said, no, I want you to oversee this extraordinary epic of the people of God by leading them out of slavery and into a land that you won't even believe how awesome it is. And Moses, of course, through a series of terrifying things, is like, I'll do it. So off they go. They go, and the chapters that follow after Exodus that time are some of the most spectacular special effects in the whole Bible. You got the Ten Commandments. You got the parting of the Red Sea. You've got manna falling down from heaven. They go to this giant mountain that sort of ends up sort of literally being on fire. He receives the Ten Commandments. Moses himself is able to go up and meet with God face to face, right? While he's hidden back in sort of cleft. The experience is so intense that when Moses comes down off of the mountain, he's literally glowing from the experience. I don't know when the last time you had a religious experience that left you physically glowing or not, but Moses had that. There was no more spiritual experience he had. Now granted, he's got some people that he's got to deal with that are driving him nuts, because the people he's called to lead are what we would call a problem. They're horrible. They can't get themselves together. They're rebelling. They're complaining. They're constantly confused. Give them a month and they will overturn everything they said they learned the month before. Sound like anybody familiar? Direct disobedience. And they have all these experiences on the way to the promised land. In one in particular that takes place in Exodus 13, they come up thirsty. And so God says he's going to do something very specific, and he wants to do a miracle for them so that they'll get it into their heads. And so what he says to Moses is, Moses, I am going to stand in front of a rock. And I want you to take your staff, you know, the magic staff that split the Red Sea and bloodied up the Nile and turned into a snake, all that stuff. And I want you to take that staff and I want you to beat the rock. But remember, God's standing in front of the rock. In other words, what God is saying is, I am going to stand in front of my people and endure a beating on behalf of them so that they can see that I and I alone am going to bring them true living water. And the water gushes out, a miracle, right? So he leads the people through the wilderness and they come to the very edge of paradise itself. They send in some spies and they come back. They're like, there's no way we can do this. And you're like, were you at the Red Sea? Did you see what God did? What do you mean there's no way you can do it? And so God pronounces a judgment on the people and says that for 40 years, you're gonna wander around. Which in itself, by the time you've read that far, you're like, yes, shut them up. Let them die. There's nothing wrong with my church that a few good funerals wouldn't solve. You ever heard people say that before? Pastors say those kind of things when you're not around. So, but here's the thing. This is the crazy part. For Moses and for Joshua and for Caleb, they actually don't get judged. They're not going to die. They're going to see it, right? But they still have to wander around with them for 40 years, waiting and waiting. Think about how that would be. Think about for Moses how miserable it was to walk around with people that by this time you clearly do not like for 40 years. Finally, at long last, they get very close and they're ready to go in. But all of a sudden, there's another water shortage. This happens in Numbers chapter 17. Numbers 20. And so they're thirsty again and they're complaining again and they're gonna walk away from God again. And so God looks and says, okay, I will feed you water. And so he leads them to another rock. And as he goes to that other rock, the instructions are quite different. This time, instead of striking the rock, the instruction is that you will speak to the rock. But the problem is, Moses is too far gone. He's had enough. And so he's like, actually, I don't think you're doing this right. And so what he chooses is he chooses the vindictive way. He's saying to himself, you really don't understand God. What I'm going to show you is what these rebels really are like. And instead of speaking to the rock, he strikes it again. Twice. Okay, now it's time for Moses to be judged. Honestly, what do you think he deserves for that little infraction? In your mind, what would be a fair judgment for what seems to be a fairly innocuous mistake when it comes to the instructions? Ready for this? No promised land for you. Literally, your entire professional life has been leading to this crescendo moment where you, in great victory at the end of your life, are going to lead this nuts people into the promised land in utter victory as a big, I told you I was right in front of all these people. And God looks and goes, yeah, actually, you're not going in. For that one little slip up. So for years, I have listened to people preach on this passage. And I hear them say things like this. Option number one goes like this. It's like, well, this is the burden that every leader faces of God. Leaders are going to incur a stricter judgment, like it says in the New Testament. And therefore, if you're going to walk with God, you just better be, if you're going to be that person who claims to lead the people of God, you better buckle up because he's going to treat you 1,000 times worse than he's going to treat other people. I'm embellishing. But it sounds like that inside my own heart. The other kind of sermon goes this way, that's kind of like, well, the lesson here is don't mess with this God. You don't know what he's going to do. You have no idea how he's going to wield his hand, right? You better buckle up because you don't know where he's going to go with all this. But I have come to believe that all these explanations are wrong because I think there's something in Moses' life that actually doesn't make sense until you look at his entire life and even his entire life after the grave. And so what I want to do is just throw out two little points here in the last 5 minutes to let you think about. And the first one is this. I've actually come to believe that I think the punishment fits the crime. Be very careful. I think it's wrong for us to look at Moses' punishment as if it was somehow something that was arbitrary, maybe capricious. We actually know what his crime was, because in Numbers 20, verse 12, it says so. This is what God says. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me. So what happened here at the end of Moses' journey is, it is his belief that fails him. And for the moment, don't get fixated on the whole, maybe he just missed the whole speaking, you know, striking thing. He just misunderstood your direction. That's not what happened. Look, you got to understand that the rock that was being struck, that water was coming out of, whether it was one or whether it was both of them, was a very big deal to the people. The rock, being a miracle of water coming out of, ended up becoming an image in the Jewish mind for provision of all kinds. So when you go back to what happened at Exodus 17, God says there in chapter 17, behold, I will stand there before the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock. Don't you see what he's saying? God is saying, I am going to associate myself with the rock. I am the rock. Which is why he decided, before you ever go into the promised land, I need to endure a beating. Which is what Exodus 17 was. It's interesting. The Apostle Paul gets the parallels later on in the New Testament, especially in 1 Corinthians 10, when Paul looks and says that the people who followed Moses, quote, drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. There are times in which you wish the Apostle Paul would be clear. This is clear. The rock, represented by this speaker, the rock is Christ, Paul says. In these people's minds, and especially the New Testament Jewish believers, they understood that there was spiritual significance to be a prefigure of Christ. It also helps you understand why Jesus talks about himself as living water and why he spoke to the woman, the Samaritan woman at the well in the way in which he did. Already you have these Old Testament hints in types and shadows, as the confession will say, of the coming rock, who would be struck on the cross for his people in the same way. But of course, it's unlikely they put those things together. But here's the difference. In Numbers 20, at the very end of these wilderness wanderings, Moses is now told to speak to the rock. Do you see why? Because if the rock is a type of Christ, like Paul says, then that rock can only be struck once. Because otherwise, that rock's efficacy to bring you living water only happens when he dies over and over and over again. And that is not the case. The whole book of Hebrews is trying to say that Christ's death was efficacious. It did what it was supposed to do for all people. From then on, after he struck, he is not struck again. He is spoken to because he's brought his people in because of his act on the cross. In other words, Moses, in the midst of his abject hatred of these people, decide that he's ready to exact a pound of flesh from these people. You know what? I'm going to show them how much they grieve God by their behavior. And he's ready to twist that vindictive screw inside of them. He takes matters into his own hands. He's going to go the human way. And he lashes out again in the hopes that maybe this next round of punishment will actually grieve you into obedience the next time. Sound familiar to you? What motivates you to be the right kind of person? Moses attempts to crucify the Lord of glory again. And so the failure at Meribah there was, this is a heinous sin that Moses committed. It's absolutely wrong, I think, to say that Moses got treated like nobody else because he was a leader. And there's no partiality with God either. Instead, what we see is Moses was standing up and exemplifying to the people of God the exact opposite of what the gracious God wanted, and as it turns out, needed his people to understand before they ever lived the life that he wanted to live in the promised land. That's the message. In short, Moses did not believe God. Because you did not believe in me. At the very end of his life, Moses' belief failed him. You know, we get to the end of this whole story and you're like, now that's a leader. I've heard many sermons about Moses as a leader. Moses was the great leader. You want to talk about great leadership lessons? Let's look at Moses' life. And here's the thing. The text supports it. What does he say there in verse 7? Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. Hey, that's commendation, right? You can imitate this man. Look at what he was. But on the edge of his life, and I think every time I read that passage in Deuteronomy, you always imagine being up there sort of looking over the promised land very nostalgically. Oh, there it is. All the great things God's going to give these people. Can you imagine how bitter that must have been? I've been studying this for a while. I think there's a case to be made that in Deuteronomy 31, Moses is far gone. There is oceans of bitterness in his speech. The message of his speech basically goes like this. It's like, look, when you get into the promised land, don't disobey. But you know what? I know you're gonna. He's lost his belief in these people. He's standing out over the promised land, embittered. And not only that, you can't even go and visit the man's grave. No one to this day knows where it is. What, do we like that mysteriousness? Oh, I wish that could happen to me. Nobody says that. Look, here's my thing. Does anyone feel like this? I don't know what it is that God's put in front of you that looks like a mountain of frustration that tempts me to pull me away from his method of dealing with me and dealing with people. But I do think that's an interesting image to think, what rock have I been pounding away at in order to rail against something that God is denying me? And has the base note of my life become one that is colored by that anger? All the therapists are saying that that's our deal, guys. It's an anger. It's a deep-seated anger that we all have. But when all of a sudden that marks my life, it's really hard to do it well, isn't it? Brian Chappell has this wonderful story where he talks about him being president at Covenant Seminary 20 years ago or so. And there was a problem with his door. It wouldn't shut all the way. And so he called a carpenter in who unhooked the door from the latches or whatnot and laid it down and started using a plane that has a little, you know what I'm talking about, where you rub it across the surface, it makes those little cool little wooden curlicues. People who are real woodworkers being like, listen to the preacher talk about woodworking. But you go across and it's making these curlicues, and Brian Chappell is watching it all go down, and without even realizing, he kind of chimes in. He's like, isn't that neat? Curlicues. And what he said was that the old carpenter, this grizzled man, goes, not when you've been doing it for 34 years, it's not. Job's like, never mind. I'll just go sit back over here. In other words, what Chappell says is, he goes, after he mounted the door, the crazy thing is after he left and he tried it, it still didn't work. And Chappell said, there's a lesson to be learned there, because the job in which you take no joy is really hard to do well. So where do I find myself spiritually in my 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s? As a man, wanting to do God's great task, build this family, sell my business for whatever I wanted to sell it for, have this experience in life. Where am I with that? Because the job I take no joy in is very hard to do well, but it seems like the circumstances of my life are always bending me towards it. Second point, and I'll finish with this. This is not the last time we hear from Moses, though, is it? Anybody thinking through their mind? When is the last time you hear from Moses? I'll give you a hint. It ain't on Mount Nebo. It's on a different mount. It's on Mount Hermon, which is a very interesting mountain in the New Testament. But all of a sudden, there's a young Jewish rabbi who has come back up on a small mountain outside Caesarea Philippi with three of his closest pupils. And all of a sudden, right in front of them, he starts to glow, this young prophet. Huh, we've seen that before, haven't we? And all of a sudden, guess who shows up? Well, the first person is Elijah. And as it turns out, there's a mirror sermon that you can preach on this exact same text for the life of Elijah, who, if you look at his amazing experience with the prophets of Baal, remember the whole fire coming down and burning up all the water and the rocks and everything else? Read it, 1 Kings somewhere or other, somewhere there. 18, 1 Kings 18. Elijah, same thing. You watch his life after that, it just declines, until he's taken away and replaced by somebody more gifted, doubly as gifted as he. How does that make you feel? But you know who else is there? It's not just Elijah. Moses is there. And he's standing up on the mountain, and what is he looking at? He's looking in the face of Jesus. And the passage there in the Gospel of Luke says, and they were talking about his exodon, is the Greek word. It's their exodus. Here's the point. Moses, in this last vision, is finally seeing what the promised land was about. The journey of the Christian life is not about whatever goal or whatever understanding, maybe even God-given, that you had pictured in this life. Because as it turns out, the promised land was not about the milk and honey. That was something else besides what was really central. The promised land was a big arrow pointing to another land, a land that would actually cover the entire earth like the waters cover the sea. It was the kingdom of God. Moses could be seen as a professional failure if you don't have the transfiguration story. Because the last time we hear from Moses, he is looking in the face of Jesus. And that's the deal, gentlemen. No matter what aspiration you set up for yourself at whatever age that this life would offer you, it all terminates in the person in the face of Jesus. It has to. Ligon Duncan said this one time in another sermon. He said, "You will know when a voice whispers in your ear, you ought to always have what your heart desires. You can be assured that that voice always speaks to you with a hiss and a forked tongue. Listen to this. But when you hear a voice say to you, 'Hey, do you see that treasure? That thing that you want more than anything else in the world? You can't have it, but you can have me instead.' Would you take that? Because that is the path." Look, at the end of Moses' life, he would be one who would all of a sudden feel alone, crushed, and abandoned, sitting up on a mountain. But there was another one coming who himself would be up on a hill, alone and crushed and abandoned. What God is saying to Moses is, "Moses, I am enough for you. I'm enough for you. The promised land, you might get in, you might not." So my therapist once told me, not a great way to start a sentence. My therapist once told me that apparently your 40s are the time in which you begin to grapple with your own death. Something to look forward to because you came tonight, right? And sure enough, my father passed away about 7 years ago, and that's why I started going to see a counselor in the first place to talk through that. That seemed important to me. And one of the things I began to do as I saw Dad fading with his lung disease that he had, he suffocated to death. It was horrible. But one of the things that I began to do is to sit there around that hospital bed and realize, I'm going to be here. Like, that's probably going to happen, you know? My sweet daughter is going to be standing around the table being like, "You know, we're just praying that the Lord would take him." That's funny. You can laugh at that. I know it's serious, but that's funny. So you lay in that moment and you start to think, with what will you console yourself in that moment? Maybe that's a little more vivid. Maybe you got to be of a certain age to really grasp that. Because here's the thing. It can't be looking back and being like, "You know what, man, I just wish I'd spent another day at the office." Or, "Man, I just really got really close to my family." Did you? Or, "Man, I'm so glad at this achievement that I..." Will anybody say that? I don't know that we will. I think if there's anything other than what we say is to say, "All I need to know is that I'm going to see Jesus." That's got to be it. That has to be all of it. Because Jesus is the only hero in the Bible. Should Moses be emulated? Absolutely, to some degree. Was Moses a screw-up who represented a failed life? Yeah. Anybody else feel like that? Let me finish with this. I had a friend of mine who had a young child upon his birth being hearing impaired, had no hearing. Now, the story ends happily in the sense that he got cochlear implants and is doing very well. But I had a conversation with him over the phone when they got the diagnosis about the child. And he explained it to me in a very powerful way. He said, "You have to understand that once you have a child that's disabled in that way, you have to realize that you've got to go through a funeral for the child you thought you were going to have. Over and over and over again, because there's all these other thresholds that when other kids cross them, your child just can't because of his disability. And so you live at these funerals on a regular basis of my hopes and my dreams and my aspirations. And I think about that all the time. That there's a sense in which we really have not understood what it means to look after a model until we realize that there ought to be this regular basis where I'm having funerals for the life that I thought that I was supposed to have. But you got to hear me. If that sounds sad to you, then it may need to be that you explore something a little more profound. What do I mean when I say I believe in Jesus? What will console me on that last day? I hope it's not that I made it into the promised land. I hope it's that my entire longing is to see his face. And if that'll happen, that's all the promised land I need, right? Something to think about. Let me pray for us. Lord Jesus, give us the grace then to begin to do some work, some internal work, figure out exactly what we've been aspiring to, what we've been looking at, what we've been longing for. And as we do, Father, it may be that we need to host little funerals over the lives that we thought we were going to have. Some of us, Father, are where we are because you've been acting in grace step after step after step. And we're so thankful for that. But none of us knows exactly what's in our future. For some of us, Father, there are turns that will take that no one can understand why you would allow those into our lives. But we will be satisfied if it terminates in you.